You have been listening to a broadcast from London. During that broadcast, leaders of the refugee governments in London have been talking to their own people in Europe, talking to them just a few hours after the start of the Allied invasion. They have been giving them instructions on how to help the Allied armies, instructions against getting panicky, against crowding the roads, instructions to get away from the beaches as soon as possible. And while that broadcast was going on, bulletins have been coming in to our NBC newsroom here in New York.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, we pause briefly for station identification.
Your station is WEAF, New York.
During the course of the last hour or so on these broadcasts that we've been hearing from London, you have heard a statement by General Dwight Eisenhower, the supreme commander of this great operation which has begun in the early hours of the morning. You have heard a statement in which General Eisenhower has addressed the people of Western Europe. In that statement, he said, a landing was made this morning on the coast of France by troops of the Allied Expeditionary Force. He repeated that statement several times in the course of his statement. A landing was made this morning on the coast of France, and German radio stations admit that our troops are now 10 miles inside Europe. That apparently means, as I said a minute ago, that we have broken the first German defense line. We've pierced a hole in it. We are 10 miles inside the fortress of Europe, that wall of steel and concrete which Hitler boasted could never be broken. But it apparently has already been broken. And now, here is another statement by General Eisenhower, an order of the day to his soldiers, in which he told them that they are embarking on a great crusade, a crusade which he said must and will end in victory. The commander warned his men that they are facing a very tough and a very well-prepared enemy, but he told them that victory would be theirs, the victory they've been preparing for and working for and striving for so many months over there in England.
Now, for the first eyewitness report of action along the channel by NBC's own battle reporter, Wright Bryan, we again take you overseas.
This is Wright Bryan speaking from London. In the first hour of D-Day by British double summer time, or a little more than an hour before D-Day began by Greenwich Mean Time, the first spearhead of Allied forces for the liberation of Europe landed by parachute in northern France. In the navigator's dome in the flight deck of a C-47, I rode across the English Channel with the first group of planes from Troop Carrier Command to take our fighting men into Europe. Just before we left French soil for the return trip to England, I watched from the rear door of our plane, named the Snooty, as 17 American paratroopers, led by Lieutenant Colonel, jumped with their arms, ammunition, and equipment into German-occupied France. Our group, at the head of the leading wing from the U.S. 9th Air Force's Troop Carrier Command, was met with only scattering small arms fire from the fields, which were dark and quiet as we entered enemy territory. As we headed back towards the English coast, we saw tracers arching through the air behind us and a steady parade of Allied planes moving out over the course we had just navigated to strengthen the ground forces we had left below. In the channel below us, we could see a few ships, but could not be certain whether they were part of the Armada carrying Allied soldiers to the beaches or attacks which were quickly following the first landings of airborne troops which I had witnessed. For 2 days, I had been living with the troop carrier squadron commanded by Major Clement G. Richardson of Salinas, California. His combat crews had been fully briefed as to their initial mission, the course they would fly, and all procedures they would follow. From the moment this briefing began, the combat crews lived apart from the ground personnel of their base, with barbed wire surrounding their quarters and guards protecting them from any contact with outside persons. All day Monday, they watched the weather. After an early supper, they broke up into small groups for volleyball games in their small recreation area. In the early evening, Major Richardson returned from a conference with Lieutenant Colonel Donaldson of Birmingham, Alabama, commanding this lead group. As Major Richardson came within the barbed wire enclosure of his own squadron, he blew a long, shrill blast on his whistle. The pilots, co-pilots, navigators, and radio men clustered around him. "Come into the briefing room," he said. There he stood in front of a large-scale map on which the course was plotted. As quickly as his men were all in the room, Major Richardson said, "Do you know your stuff?" There was no word of dissent spoken. Said Major Richardson, "Get your stuff and report to the operations room immediately. I'm going down to the colonel to get the weather report. I think this is it. Good luck." The crews began to file out of the room, but Major Richardson stopped them. "You want to get back, don't you?" he asked. There was a quick murmur of assent. "Then, damn it, get in there and fight." The crews piled in their trucks to go first to the operations office and then to the line where their planes were drawn up and ready to go. As they moved towards the airport proper, they passed long columns of airborne troops, trudging slowly under their full loads of battle equipment from the bivouac area where they had been camped awaiting this day toward the planes which would carry them into battle. General Eisenhower had visited this camp during the afternoon, quietly passing among the men and chatting with them, asking them names and their homes and their jobs. Outside the door of each C-47, the soldiers assembled and checked their equipment, while ground crews and combat crews gave the planes a final tuning up. Heavily laden transport planes began taxiing along in long procession toward the runway. As the first squadron, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel David Daniel of Birmingham, Alabama, began to take off, the planes rushing in swift succession down the runway, Lieutenant General Lewis H. Brereton, the 9th Air Force commander, moved up and down the line of planes, giving the thumbs-up sign to his crews. Meantime, the paratroopers had adjusted their packs, donned their May Wests and chutes, and climbed into the planes. Each was so heavily loaded that he had to be pushed from behind and pulled from above to get up the steps into the plane. In our plane, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Cole of San Antonio, Texas, the senior officer aboard, moved quietly up and down the passenger compartment, speaking to each man and asking if he had everything he needed. As the men settled in their bucket seats, Colonel Cole said, "The doc is going to give you some pills to guard against air sickness. Make yourselves as comfortable as you can. Better try to sleep a little." Quiet settled in the plane. These men had done their talking. Now they were grim and silent. The soldier sitting farthest forward on the port side, Private Robert C. Hillman of Manchester, Connecticut, said, "I know my chute's okay because my mother checked it. She worked in the Pioneer Parachute Company in our town, and her job is giving the final once-over to all chutes they manufacture." On the flight deck of our plane, the Snooty, Lieutenant John E. Peters of Chicago, the pilot, and Lieutenant B.E. Maxwell of Clay of Michigan muttered soft curses as their motors were slow to start after a long pause on the taxi strip. But when the engines did turn over, they droned steadily and powerfully. Almost before we knew it, we were trundling along past the operations buildings and the control tower, where all the ground personnel of the base were standing. Some held thumbs up. Some made the V sign. Some waved. It was like the takeoff of a big mission from a bomber station, only more so. This was the first combat mission for this outfit, and everyone on the base knew that this was the day. Our ship was leading the second section of the second squadron in the first group. As we picked up speed on the long runway, I stood between the pilot and co-pilot and watched formation lights of the ships ahead of us slowly, almost imperceptibly climbing, then gradually swinging into wide circles. "This thing is really loaded down," said Pilot Pete, and as we became airborne, you could almost feel the sturdy transport strengthening its muscles and shouldering its burden. Then, foot by foot, almost inch by inch, rising above the fields and trees of southern England. As our squadron fell into its formation, three Vs of three ships each in the first section and three Vs of three ships each in the second section, which we were leading,
The preceding squadron was already circling the home field, now gaining altitude more rapidly. Other squadrons followed us. Soon the entire group was in the air. All about us and below us was such a glimmering fabric of lights as I had not seen in the 8 months I had been in blacked-out England. Four times we circled the field, its runways and perimeter outlined in sparkling white lights. Through the sky, formation lights of the planes strung out almost to the limit of vision, looking for all the world like holiday decorations stretching down the length of any American main street. As the long procession straightened out on its pre-established course toward the shore of the English Channel, signal lights blinked, and navigators checked their speed and direction with the pilots and began their continuous plotting of position. As we headed toward the coast, the bulky transports silhouetted against the sky as they gently undulated in the pop wash of their companions. Reaching the first point for change of course, our plane blinked its signal light, and Pete said to his co-pilot, "Want to take it now, Maxie?" And Maxie took over the controls. "Right on course, and we're 1 minute early," reported navigator Robert E. Taylor of Altoona, Pennsylvania. At that moment, I left the glass blister in the forward roof of the fuselage, sometimes called the astral globe, sometimes called the navigating dome, from which I had been watching the formations about me, too fascinated to feel the weight of the flak suit, which, like all crew members, I was wearing, or the steel helmet, which I was pressing against the ceiling. Down the long passenger cabin, I walked to see how the paratroopers were riding. More than half of them had taken their colonel's advice and were dozing with their heads back against the wall and their feet stretched out in front of them. The others were sitting silently, except for two or three who talked among themselves in whispers. By the open rear door, Colonel Cole waited and said, "It's cold back here with the wind whipping in." I had been perspiring in the crew's cabin up front, but back where the colonel sat, I was glad I wore heavy clothing. More signal lights blinked as we crossed the coast of England and pushed out across the channel. The sea was calm, its steely grayness blending in the half-light with the dingier gray of the horizon. But soon the moon brightened the water and made the ripples below us twinkle. The ship on our wing, its heavy fuselage outlined against the water, but its wings obscured from my angle of vision, looked, but for the high tail fin, like a giant whale rising and falling in the easy swells. Halfway across the channel, planes one by one switched out their formation lights. "Where's all this fighter protection we were going to have?" muttered the pilot. We had not seen a plane outside our own formations, but the fighters must have done their work well, for there was no sign of enemy aircraft about. "Tiny, tell the colonel it's 30 minutes until jump time," yelled Pilot Pete. And the fat, husky crew chief, Staff Sergeant Richard A. Eberly of Indianapolis, whose father is a major in the Air Corps, shouldered his way back to give the word to Colonel Cole. And then, turning my eyes from the occasional lights and flares which glowed on the Channel Islands, I looked straight ahead and caught my first glimpse of the coast of France. I had never visited the continent of Europe in peacetime, and I was waiting for invasion day to visit it in wartime. The pilot and the co-pilot, too, were seeing this coast for the first time. None of us spoke, but each looked at the other. The navigation had been perfect. We could see the beach ahead of us precisely at the point we had studied it on maps, on aerial photographs, and on carefully modeled relief maps. The moon was almost full. Clouds were riding occasionally in front of it, but visibility was excellent. As our strong ship Snooty crossed above the breakers into the air of France, we plunged into a bank of cloud or fog and lost sight of the planes around us. For a matter of 2 or 3 minutes, we were flying formation on instruments. Then we emerged into clear moonlight, and below the rear door of the plane, almost close enough, it seemed, to step out without a parachute. The small fields looked peaceful with their orderly hedgerows. It almost seemed you could see the furrows. Now the paratroopers were on their feet, each adjusting his packs and snapping his ripcord over the static line, a cable which ran along the center of the cabin ceiling so that each chute would open automatically as its wearer jumped through the door. "You all set?" asked the colonel. "Get this thing hooked for me," he said, as he took his own place closest to the door. The jump lights, a small bank of signal lamps, were gleaming beside the door. They blinked as the pilot threw his switch, and before I could look up, they began jumping. I wanted to know how long it would take the 18 men to jump. I tried to count 101, 102, 103 to estimate the number of seconds. Before I had counted to 10 seconds, may have been 11 or 12, but no more, our passengers had left us, all but one of them. The paratroopers shoved each other so swiftly and heavily towards the open door that they jolted against the doorframe. One man among the last half dozen hit the rear of the door so heavily that he was thrown into the back of the cabin and dazed. The men behind shoved him aside and went on jumping. Before the unhappy soldier could get to his feet, our plane was well past the drop zone, and in a matter of minutes it was back over the water and setting a course for home. It was too late, and that soldier had to return with us. He was unconsolable. He thought his comrades might think him yellow. The plane crew assured him that they would think no such thing, but he sat moody and glum all the way back and appealed for lonely instructions when he returned. As soon as I had watched the jumps from the rear door, I ran back to the front of the ship and looked straight back from the glass dome. Tiny streams of tracer bullets were curving upward from the ground, but they were well behind us. One of the pilots in our squadron had unwittingly left on his formation lights, and the tracers came closest to his wingtips. But we saw nothing that looked like heavy ack-ack except in the far distance. Our course had been well plotted and navigated to avoid the known German batteries. We were over France only 11 minutes. With our ships lightened by unloading their cargo, we picked up speed and streaked for home. Behind us, we could still see the tracers and an occasional flare. Below, a few more ships, but we couldn't tell just what they were. The Battle of Europe had begun, and our squadron had delivered the first Allied foot soldiers to their scene of action.
This is Wright Bryan
in London, returning you to New York.
You have just been listening to NBC's war correspondent, Wright Bryan, the first man to come back from the invasion and make a report to America by air. Wright Bryan is from NBC's WSB in Atlanta, Georgia. He is also managing editor of the Atlanta Journal. And now here's a bulletin from Washington. Headquarters of the European Theater of Operations reports to the U.S. War Department that Allied aircraft covering the invasion are hitting any target which has any bearing on the strength of the armies at the front.
Ladies and gentlemen, the National Broadcasting Company has brought you the news to the moment. There'll be more news of vital importance to the world tonight, so stay tuned to your NBC station. Now, while we await further transmissions from overseas, we invite you to listen to the Star-Spangled Banner. Ladies and gentlemen, our national anthem. Briefly for station identification.
WEAF, New York.
NBC further covers the news. At this time, ladies and gentlemen, we bring you the Dean of News Commentators, H.V. Kaltenborn.
We have already had a description of the first landings on French soil by American paratroopers. That tells us that the first spearhead paratroops landed approximately 15 miles from the coast of France. The plane carrying this spearhead was over France only 11 minutes, which would give them the opportunity of getting in approximately that distance. That agrees with all the other things that we have heard with regard to these early operations, for we have already had news that we are fighting the enemy some 10 miles from the French coast. That fighting, obviously, is not being carried on by troops that have landed from barges, but is carried on by the large number of paratroopers which have already been landed on the French coast, presumably in the vicinity of the mouth of the Seine. Since, according to all reports from Germany that we have had thus far, some of the heaviest fighting is going on in that area. That is only natural, since our first operation would be destined to seize for the Allied forces one of the larger ports of France in order that our ships, our heavy ships, could get in to suitable landing facilities. Le Havre is the largest, best port in northern France, and it is only natural that it would be our objective, in spite of the fact that it is approximately 80 miles from the British coast instead of the shorter 20-mile distance directly across the channel. Wright Bryan from London has just given us a description of how these first paratroopers, crossing over in their aerial transports, jumped out of the plane. He gave us a dramatic description of how 17 out of the 18 men jumped, and one who struck the door as he started to make the jump was dazed, and before he had recovered, the plane had passed the appointed place of landing, and consequently, he could not drop. Only scattering small arms fire met these first planes. That is an indication that the Germans were not ready with anti-aircraft fire at all points along the coast, for obviously, small arms fire is not likely to be effective against planes. There was a steady parade of these planes. We know that many, many thousands of paratroopers have been ready for D-Day, and all the paratroopers are likely to be thrown into action in the early hours, since they must pave the way for the landings that are to be made from barges. They must cut the communications. They must attempt to seize an airfield, for the seizure of an airfield is one of the first operations that are undertaken by paratroops, since if we once have one airfield, we can then make direct landings of troops in large numbers with gliders, we can establish an invasion center in the interior, and we are then prepared for the rapid development of the real invasion operations. There were no German fighter planes in sight as these first paratroopers approached. That is an indication of the extent to which our men, our flyers, have succeeded in eliminating German aerial opposition. That, too, is of good omen, for at the moment, we are fairly sure that German aerial might will not be equal to meeting the crisis that faces them at this particular moment. We know from the broadcast of the Prime Minister of Belgium that Belgium is probably not to be invaded immediately. He warned against resistance, said that supreme combat for the Belgians has not yet arrived. We know that because of the landings made at various points, that the invasion is on a very large scale. We will have constant developments minute by minute from now on.
Thank you, Mr. Kaltenborn. And now we hear from another of NBC's reporters overseas. Here is John Vandercook speaking from London.
Announcement has just been made that the invasion of Western Europe has begun. The feints and diversions promised by Winston Churchill and hinted at by the military experts have now been relegated to the limbo of dead words. 250,000 people will say today, this is really it. This is the Queen's move, straight across the board. The astronomical numbers of planes that for weeks past have been pulverizing rod by rod and yard by yard. Every German position from literally the beginning of shallow water to far within the hinterland of France have now, with close naval support, been followed by the paratroopers, the landing boats, the infantry. Beachhead is a narrow term. By all present indications, General Eisenhower and his field commander, the great Montgomery of Egypt and North Africa, have attacked along miles of the French coast. The textbook pattern of invasion, and this, of course, is the most massive such operation in all human history, calls for the early possession by the attacker of good seaports. The purpose of that is clear. A major offensive against an enemy-held coast requires, swiftly after its commencement, the possession by the initiators of the attack of harbors capable of the unloading of far weightier materiel than can be put ashore even by the incredibly versatile and numerous amphibian landing craft. That is probably an essential part of the Allied plan, as it is now being put in practice. Be sure of it, we are moving with the weight of mountains. In his order of the day issued to each man in the Allied Expeditionary Force, General Dwight Eisenhower calls this mighty mission the Great Crusade. He adds, the eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. General Eisenhower makes this solemn promise. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed people of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. And the Supreme Commander warns, the enemy will fight savagely. He is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. The final words of the General's orders have the lift that at this hour in England has raised every heart. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck. And let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking. American, British, and Canadian forces under the direct command of General Bernard L. Montgomery are carrying out the first gigantic phase of the attack. The skies are ahum with the ceaseless passage of great planes that shuttle smoothly back and forth from the countless airfields of England to the scene of battle almost within eyesight of the British shore. The English ports are pouring cornucopias of the long garnered riches of men and war machines that have been assembled through these many, many months for this long-awaited hour. I return you now to New York.
The National Broadcasting Company continues its coverage of this first step in the Allied liberation of Europe with a report from the Pentagon Building in Washington.
We're speaking from the NBC broadcasting booth in the Pentagon Building, the War Department's headquarters in Washington. NBC will broadcast from this nerve center of the Army of the United States in the days to come, prepared to give you day-by-day invasion news. Just a short while ago, the War Department issued a statement by General John J. Pershing, Commander-in-Chief of the American Expeditionary Force in the last war. General Pershing's statement says, and I quote, "American troops have landed in Western Europe. As the overmastering military might of the Allies advances, it will be joined by the men of the occupied countries whose land has been overrun by the enemy, but whose spirit remains unconquered. 26 years ago, American soldiers, in cooperation with their allies, were locked in mortal combat with the German enemy. Their march of victory was never halted until the enemy laid down his arms in defeat. The American soldier of 1917 and 1918, fighting in a war of liberation, wrote by his deeds one of the most glorious pages of military history. Today, the sons of American soldiers of 1917 and 1918 are engaged in a like war of liberation. It is their task to bring freedom to peoples who have been enslaved. I have every confidence that they, together with their gallant brothers in arms, will win through to victory." And that's the text of a statement by General John J. Pershing, Commander-in-Chief of the 1st AEF. This is the Pentagon Building, the massive structure across the Potomac River from Washington, which is the headquarters of the Army of the United States. Here is where the invasion was born. Here, and at a plain white building on the Washington side of the river, a heavily guarded building in which sit the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Pentagon is the largest office building in the world, only three stories tall, but its floor space is greater than the Empire State Building in New York, and rightly so. Here in the Pentagon are the offices of Secretary of War Stimson and Army Chief of Staff General George Marshall and 35,000 other persons, Army officers and civilians. For years now, they've been working on invasion plans, not directly, but in their routine paperwork. In the midst of all the paraphernalia of a great military machine, the directives, the channels, and yes, even the red tape, the plans for D-Day were taking form. The invasion story broke at the Pentagon early this morning, while most of Washington was asleep across the Potomac. It was brought by newspaper and radio reporters who had been routed out of the bed by their offices. They descended on the Army Bureau of Public Relations like a flock of locusts. All they had to go on were German radio reports. A few, very few, Army officers sat around and said nothing. They answered all inquiries politely, but by the time you'd call your office to relay the word, you realized you'd learned nothing. It was calm in this gigantic five-sided building throughout the night. There were a few lights burning in the public relations office and some others which had been burning all night in offices where unauthorized persons can't enter. Well, we sat and waited. The Germans did all the talking. And then came H hour, the moment of history. Army officers appeared with a flock of mimeographed sheets. There was a brief scramble as the reporters fought for a copy of the official communique, and then a mad race to telephones and broadcasting studios. It was official. In a few hours, the 35,000 workers at the Pentagon will come back to their jobs, and the daily routine will begin all over again. The official-looking forms, the long rows of filing cabinets, the thousands of clicking typewriters. For the Pentagon, it'll be another day as usual. D-Day is past. Now the long uphill drive begins. From the Pentagon building, we take you now to the NBC newsroom in Washington.
This is Richard Harkness in the NBC newsroom in Washington. The War Department, ladies and gentlemen, has just issued a bulletin. The War Department says that specially trained, picked assault teams of the United States Army made that initial attack on Fortress Europe, knocking out pillboxes and other fortifications of the vaunted Atlantic Wall. And then the War Department, in an official dispatch straight from a front-line town on the coast of England, tells us this story. The jump off of Allied troops for the invasion of Europe began in a small way from that frontline town in England, which is yet unnamed. And the War Department report says that first, several advance parties of the assault troops marched into the landing stages of this port in England. They clambered aboard the blunt-nosed assault craft, and a little later, climbed on the larger craft, swinging at anchor farther out in the harbor.
We interrupt this program to take you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
For another overseas broadcast, the National Broadcasting Company takes you now to London.
Supreme Headquarters. I have just seen the first American troops preparing to storm ashore onto the continent of Europe. They were about to land on the north coast of France at 6:30 British summer time this morning. At 6:23, the Marauder bomber in which I was riding dropped the last load of bombs to be launched onto the coastal targets before H hour a few minutes later, when our landing barges would strike the shore. All night and from dawn onwards, thousands of Allied planes have been softening up a strip of coast. Already several thousand paratroopers are waiting further inland to join forces with the landing parties. These airborne troops were flown in last night. I could see evidence of the landings in a number of parachutes lying in the little fields. But I must say at once, the amazing feature of my flight this morning was the almost unbelievable quietness of the scene below, where in the next few days, maybe in the next few hours, decisive battles for the reconquest of Europe will be fought. For with the exception of German tanks, which are moving up the roads towards the beachhead, or hiding in hedges, we saw no signs of enemy resistance. As our flight of 54 marauders made their bomb run along the enemy coast, we were met by only a few puffs of inaccurate flak, and by machine gun fire, machine guns firing from 40 to 50 German tanks.
I'd like to record here that Sergeant Paul Scott of Cedartown, Georgia, the waist gunner beside whom I was riding, promptly turned his machine guns on the one German tank by a crossroads and claims to have set it on fire. I saw the tank burning. Apart from those tanks, a few bursts of flak, and one report of a coastal battery, I saw no signs of the enemy. Everything that flew in the air or sailed on the sea was definitely and overwhelmingly ours. You'll have to forgive the superlatives, but they're an accurate description of the facts in this case. The air and sea armadas I saw this morning were the biggest nations at war have ever launched at one time. At briefing, before we took off at dawn, the pilots were told to stay below 6,000 feet over England, because that was the level assigned them. Higher up and lower down, the air was full of other planes, fortresses, liberators, lightnings, thunderbolts, spitfires, all forming up before flying south to the same target we were headed for. I could see hundreds of planes crossing and crisscrossing below us, and the pilots of our ship called out over the intercom telephone, "There are planes strung out ahead and behind us like strings of sausages." Even more incredible was what we could see on the water, 3,000 feet below us. Ships were moving from the coast of England in immense convoys. In some convoys, the ships were sailing in single file. In others, they were in various patterns. From above, they looked like water beetles scuttling backwards and forwards over a pond. The sea was calm with occasional white caps. We left these vast convoys and passed over them for a long time. There were literally ships as far as the eye could reach, and it can reach a long way from 5,000 feet up. We crossed enemy territory at 6:18 and began our bomb run down the coast. Off to our left, it was the north, I could see the dim shapes of ships, some of them close to shore. There were warships among them. The country 3,000 feet below us was flat and marshy. Further inland, it was crisscrossed with neat green and brown fields, all divided by low hedges. Farms, roads, hamlets, and enemy tanks were all plain to the naked eye. As the weather was clear, the sun was shining on Brittany, and visibility was good. Then things began to happen fast. First, our 18 250-pound bombs were away. I watched these and the other bombs cascading down from our formation. When they hit the earth, they seemed to draw out plumes of dirty, oily yellow smoke, which grew and joined together until the whole invasion strip of coast was covered in a great pall of smoke. Through this, I could see the flashes of our naval guns. There was no answering fire from coastal batteries. From the amount of high explosive we were pouring on that strip of land down there, it seemed impossible for anything, however small and however deeply hidden, to survive. From time to time, word would come over the intercom phones to keep an eye out on some plane at 2 o'clock or 9 o'clock, which is an air crew's way of giving compass bearings. But though our gunners trained their guns several times, not a single enemy fighter or plane of any kind was sighted. In fact, the only time our guns were fired was when the boys cut loose at those German tanks. It was the same all the way out and all the way back to England. Apart from machine gun fire from the German tanks moving up to counterattack our forces as they landed, our flight was as peaceful as a sky ride between New York and Chicago. This is James Wellard in London. I return you now to the United States.
And from the NBC newsroom in New York, ladies and gentlemen, we continue our report of the coverage of the invasion with Robert St. John.
Here's a bulletin from London which says Allied invasion troops opened the Battle of Europe today with a deep penetration by American and British parachute forces far behind the coast of northern France. It says that landings were made in overwhelming strength along the beaches between the Seine River and Cherbourg. German broadcasts admit that heavy fighting is going on 10 miles inland from the Normandy coast. The German reports describe the invasion as a gigantic operation, which they say included powerful air forces and heavy warships. One version is that battleships covered the landing with their fire. From Supreme Headquarters has just come an announcement that the fleet taking part in the invasion does include several battleships, which the Germans say set the whole Seine area ablaze with their fire. And the Germans have just announced that American reinforcements landing at dawn were aided by artificial fire. And the Nazis say that dummy parachutists were dropped in some places just to confuse the defense. Guns of Allied naval forces are operating in a stunning long-range bombing of Germany's defensive positions all along the entire French coastline, says another bulletin. The Germans say Allied bombers ranged as far north as Dunkirk, that unhappy port from which the beaten British army escaped exactly 4 years ago. All of England resounded with the thunder of their coming and going, says one dispatch. An Associated Press correspondent flying over the French coast in a B-26 Marauder reports seeing fields in France strewn with hundreds of parachutes and also dotted with gliders. And here's a story from a UP correspondent in London who says thousands of Allied planes and the guns of warships, which were drawn from the mightiest fleets in history, laid down an earth-shaking bombardment of the French coast in order to cover landings of shock troops by both parachute and ship. As the invasion got underway, Air Force headquarters announced that the U.S. 9th Air Force is now flying more fighter-bomber missions with more aircraft than any other Air Force in history.
NBC continues its coverage of the invasion news with a report now from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
And this is Richard Harkness in Washington. Only a few minutes ago, the War Department issued an official communique, an official description of our invasion forces operating from a front-line town in the coast of England. Now, this, of course, was an unnamed jump-off point for Allied troops for the invasion of Europe. And the report describes it this way. First, several advance parties of the assault troops marched into the landing stages of this port. They clambered aboard the little blunt-nosed assault craft, and a little later, they climbed on the larger craft swinging at anchor farther out in the harbor. Then, second, gangs of service troops began loading the rations that will sustain the American and English task force while seaborne between England and the European continent. An officer said that there were enough rations put aboard the landing craft to last 8 days, plus 1 day of emergency combat rations. Now, none of the food loaded by the service troops was intended for use on the beaches after the assault troops land. For the first day of land operations, each soldier has been issued 1 day's emergency rations. And after that time, of course, field kitchens will be in operation and hot food served. Now, these final preparations in England were carried out very quietly and without tension by the Army and Navy. They were carried out, too, almost under the noses of the civilian population of this little town in England without attracting the slightest bit of attention. The War Department report said that the assembly areas along the British coastline were changed into marshalling areas beginning on Sunday, and troops were briefed as to their exact missions and reshuffled from battalions into craft loads ready to move at a moment's notice. During this time, the marshalling point was attacked by German aircraft. The result of the enemy action was comparatively minor. And for a week before the jump-off, the troops were billeted in the town, and they were closely restricted to quarters. They were ordered not to talk to civilians and not to talk to any unbriefed soldiers. That is the War Department description of Preparedness Day in a little town on the coast of England. And here is another bulletin from London. Elmer Davis, the director of our Office of War Information, has a warning for the American public. He tells us that the German radio, which broke this historic invasion story, may be trying to build up a reputation for accuracy in their news reports of the invasion, so they can put one over on the Allies later. Elmer Davis is asking Americans to remember that Mr. Goebbels is in business for his health and not for yours. Davis makes this statement. The enemy radio is broadcasting reports in their own interests and not in ours. What they have said thus far may be entirely true. I don't know, Davis goes on, because I haven't been following it. but the only information on the development of the invasion that can be relied on will be issued by Allied headquarters.